This is episode 2 of The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
All the way from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders with Mary and Blake. It's a podcast dedicated to the show The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk about the pilot. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. Hi everyone, I'm your host, Mary Larson.
And I'm Blake, and I would love to go to a parade on We Don't Know What the Fuck Happened Day. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't that be awesome?
She's just mean. That's what, all I can say. I don't really
like
her.
What a bitch of a mayor.
She's really not so nice. I'm not a big fan of her.
Like, why are you shitting on the captain? I mean, the chief. He's a nice guy.
And he's nice looking. Maybe that's why. She's jealous.
She's wicked jelly.
Maybe she's just, you know, has a lot of angst. Who knows? But let's just jump into the show. Let's recap. And the way that Blake and I recap an episode is we call it, Let's Reheat the Leftovers.
It's time to reheat the leftovers.
All right, so it starts off in the laundromat with that mom doing her laundry like every other parent does. Busy day, puts the baby in the car, turns around, baby's not there.
I know. This was the scene that I was waiting for, but I was also dreading at the same time. Because, you know, like we said on our last episode, we have a one-year-old. And just knowing that this kid was going to disappear was terrifying. And I didn't even know how to handle it as it was happening. So it's one of those things that you kind of wish that, oh my God, sometimes I just wish my kid would go away. Stop bothering me. But this actually happened in the show, and it was terrifying.
It was so sad. You know, she turns around. She gets the help from everybody. There's the kid who loses his dad. The car then crashes. I mean, chaos is ensuing. The one critique I had about this scene, it was awesome. I mean, it was beautifully done. I just wish I hadn't seen it in the previews.
I know.
Because it was so powerful. Like, especially as you said, you know, we have this one-year-old. We see this dread. Even if you don't have a kid of your own, this is a very scary scene to watch. Mm-hmm. But because I'd already seen it so many times before watching Game of Thrones, I felt a little bit like the epic nature of it didn't hit me as much as I wished it had, because it was so powerful. How about you? What did you think since you'd had seen it in previews?
I thought it was still just as powerful. The thing that really got me, actually, was there was no opening sequence for this show. It just, boom, you're right into it. And you see that this kid is going to disappear. And again, the dread of knowing that was going to happen from the previews, and then seeing it happen, and then the total alarm and disbelief of this woman that her kid was just gone now.
And the sound that they had during that scene, it was pretty unique.
Like that music, it was like that sound that was made by, what's the thing that's on Harry Potter?
The
Horcruxes. It reminded me of that. You know, like that sound.
Makes you just want to rub your neck like Voldemort does when he rolls his head.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And I loved it. I thought it was a great scene. And the thing that I like about it, too, is it's a small-time thing in comparison to the overarching people disappearing throughout the whole world. But it really hit home with this idea of a mother and a baby. And I give props to Peter Berg, the director of this episode, too, how he handled it and how he panned from one end of the car to the next and again. And then all of a sudden, you see the moment of relief on the lady's face that the kid stopped crying. She's like, oh, thank God. Oh, my God. My goddamn kid stopped finally crying. She looked back and the kid's gone. And then Peter Berg, with like his shaky cam style, totally caught the emotion of it, and I loved it. I thought it was phenomenal.
It was great. And then, of course, it cuts to 3 years later, mm-hmm, with that piano medley that the melody kept showing up throughout the episode. It was really simple, but had a little bit of a, like a little spooky, eerie nature, yet very simple. And I think that that is just what you said. Like, this whole show is taking place in this really simple, small town. Mm-hmm. So that's what I liked about the piano. It wasn't some huge orchestration. It was just reminding you we're simple folk here. And it starts, of course, with the police chief going out on a run.
Yeah, Kevin Garvey living life like just a regular everyday thing. Like, hey, no, I don't care if people disappeared. I'm still going to move on. Now, later on in the show, we kind of end up realizing that it's all kind of a facade, really.
Because it needs to be. But while he's on this run, first off, I need to talk about something. He's running with a fanny pack. Did you notice this? Yeah, it was on the back. So it was a backwards fanny pack.
Get out of here, really?
Swear to God, rewind. Fanny pack, you're awesome. Then.
What is this, 1992?
You know, who knows?
Are you going to break out the Stada jackets and like the Charlotte Hornets pants? Really?
So then this dog shows up. I don't really like dogs. All right. Let's just get this party started by letting me say I don't like dogs, and that was not a cute dog.
No, that was a cute dog.
Not in my opinion. For someone who doesn't like dogs, that was not a pretty dog. So then it comes up and he's trying to talk to this dog. Buddy, you and your fanny pack should know better than approaching strange dogs.
I thought you would appreciate the dog. The dog's name was Dudley.
I felt bad once the dog died. I'm not gonna lie, I felt bad. I mean, I don't want dogs to die. I just don't like them.
You're not a dog killer?
No. So that was freaky.
Leave it to HBO, right? First, they make a baby disappear, right? And then all of a sudden, they kill an innocent dog.
All within 5 minutes. It's babies like, and dogs
that's
dead.
It. Gone. See you later. We don't care about anything that's innocent or good in this planet. Huh. We're just going to get rid of everybody. Screw it.
I mean, it took, what was that movie, I Am Legend? It took till like the very end of the movie for him to kill his dog.
I cried at that part.
And The Walking Dead, that baby still isn't dead. Baby's still alive. But you're right, HBO said, we don't care.
Yeah, and they did it on Game of Thrones too. Remember that season one? They had the guy just like stab the little baby. Oh my God.
HBO, you're just killing me. But so he kills his dog and he drives off
He tries to stop the guy. And I think this says something about the world that they're in. It's all a facade. Everybody moving on with their lives. But people are like totally messed up.
We're going to get back to this.
Yeah.
You want to know my thing?
What?
I don't even think there's a guy in a truck. I think he shot the dog himself.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, no. Let's save that.
Save that.
Let's save that.
All right. Continue. Okay. So then we cut to the cult, these weird people who are smoking as soon as they wake up.
Oh, I know. And she just, as soon as she wakes up, she looks up and she lights a butt, you know, like, and
talk about halitosis. I mean, really, if you're a smoker, you got some nasty breath anyway, and maybe you just cover it up, smoking it right away. You don't need to brush your teeth.
Yeah, I know.
Just smoke.
And then one of the things that I really liked about this scene too, it just kind of got shot in there, was a memory of a fight between two girls. It was very quick hit.
Oh, like a school. It was like a schoolyard.
Yeah,
they were in uniforms.
Yeah. And the thing why I'm bringing this up is because the show, during the editing, they do this kind of flashback stuff throughout the show. Very quick hits, almost disorienting.
Yeah.
And, you know, you saw the one later on, we'll get into it with Tom, about the people jumping off the building. You see the one with Kevin about his father going crazy, running through like cop style, you know, like naked. You know, all you see is this big white ass.
What you want to do.
So I love that idea, how they're bringing that kind of storytelling device in. It's not used as prevalently as in Lost, but you're still getting quick hits, and it gives you that a small bit of exposition that I like.
It's like stream of consciousness.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you don't think in these long, epic things. You have little flashes, little memories. So.
Yeah, so like, what the hell does that fight mean? I have no idea.
And who was she in the fight?
Exactly.
Was she a bystander?
And why is Lori thinking about it at that very moment? Who knows?
They showed that sign that says, we don't smoke for enjoyment, we smoke for faith.
Oh, I know, it's to proclaim our faith, right? Isn't that messed up? And I think a lot of people have had their ideas on what this cigarette smoking thing is. For me, it seems to be a tangible sacrament about their faith, that they're just living their lives and they don't care if they croak. They don't care if they get lung cancer, because the world's going to end anyway. And what does it matter? What happened? Like, who gives a shit if the world ends? And who gives a shit if we get cancer?
I'm confused, though. Where are these people getting this money for these McMansions and all these cigarettes? Because I don't smoke cigarettes, but I see how much they cost.
It's like 10 bucks a pack now.
And they're chain smokers.
Oh, I know.
So they're getting money from somewhere.
I know. Well, the good thing is that in the book, and yes, I have read the book. I did finish it. In the book, they do tell you where they're getting it from.
Oh, thank goodness.
But it's supplied by the Guilty Remnant. And what they do is they buy in bulk these really shitty cigarettes that taste like crap. Oh. And they pass them out. But the thing is, too, well, where are they getting all the money from? You know, and why are they living in these big, beautiful homes?
In those beautiful homes, there was this really quick shot, which shook me to the bone more than the smoking. Mm-hmm. Do you remember seeing that shot with all the wall covered in picture, like photo, picture frames, but they were empty?
Yes, no pictures.
I hated that.
Isn't that creepy?
They didn't even keep in the fake pictures that you get when you buy it at CVS, and there's like a really good looking couple or like a cute baby, and then you put your picture in, and you're like, those people looked better.
we kind of suck.
Yeah, that was terrible.
I know. No, it's really creepy. It's almost, again, a reminder to them that all of it is just a waste of time. And, you know, we'll eventually talk about this too, with the sign, stop wasting your breath. That's their whole motto. This life, it doesn't matter, because sooner or later, this world's going to end, and it's coming to an abrupt end.
So are we supposed to think that these people, the Guilty Remnant, are believers in the rapture because they think it's going to end now in 4 years? Because that's what it is, right? The rapture, people leave, and then
7 years
come
later,
back 7 years.
Okay. 7 years later, the world literally ends.
So are we led to believe that these people in this are believers in that they think they're going to die? Or are we supposed to believe that they don't believe in anything and don't care?
I think philosophically, they pick and choose what they want to believe. Like the whole Jesus thing, maybe they don't necessarily believe in Jesus, but they definitely do pick and choose what they believe about the rapture. And they still think that, yes, 7 years from now, this world's going to end. And everything else that's happening right now, all the relationships that you have, it doesn't matter. And they're just waiting. And there's no point in living your life.
They are so negative. I would like to create a cult that's the exact opposite. That's called the Happy Remnant. And say, I have 4 years left. Let's go to Disney World. Let's travel the world. Let's eat cake. Lots and lots and lots of chocolate peanut butter cake. I mean, have a happy... Live in a mansion and be happy, guys. Add some color into your life. My goodness.
Yeah, the white gets a little oppressive, doesn't it?
How do you keep that clean? They must buy a lot of bleach, too.
Well, after that big riot that they had,
they kept dirty.
Oh, my God. They were like all covered in blood and everything.
Oh, they need some wet naps.
Lots and lots of wet naps. Maybe that Clorox bleach pen.
I love those. So you're saying how you think some of them might have faith in different things.
Yes.
What about that scientist? Remember how they were saying there was, what was it, Congress that was interviewing different people?
Oh, yeah.
They were interviewing different religious leaders, and then they were interviewing the scientists.
This is why, I mean, look, this show got rave reviews, and I know when you and I had talked about it, you said, I like this show, but I didn't love it. And I liked it. One of the great things that Lindelof and Perotta chose to do was they used the TV and like the newscasts and everything as the device for the exposition for the whole show. Meaning, we're following Mapleton. We're following Kevin Garvey and his family. But this is a global scale thing. 140 million people disappeared. And what do they do to get that idea stuck in your head? They use like CNN or whatever the equivalent is into the show. I forget what it is. And this commission, the Denzinger Commission, and you see it playing in the background all the time. So they're not wasting your precious time as an audience doing the exposition of like, well, sir, what happened here? You know, they're not doing that. They're telling their story, but in the background, they got these people talking about it. It reminded me a lot of 9/11. I was a freshman in college. I think you were a sophomore in college for 9/11. Yes. I remember constantly, the news was always on all the time. Anywhere you went, it was always on CNN or NBC or Fox or whatever. And the talking heads were always talking, always fucking talking about the World Trade Center. And it was always kind of bringing you down. And you can never move past it because they just kept talking about it. like Wolf Blitzer and all these guys. So it was great to see that kind of little bit of reality in the show.
See, for me, you know, it really made me feel a lot like 9/11. Even that scene at the end when they're at the bar and the mom's asking, where were you when it happened?
Oh, I know.
That was, I feel like my sophomore year, one of the top weird conversations you'd have. And honestly, every September 11th, whoever you end up seeing, most likely that comes up in your conversation with someone. Hey, where were you when it happened? Where were you when the planes hit the Twin Towers? Where were you throughout that day? And you know, it just became this silence that day. And being a resident assistant on that day, I had to go and counsel a lot of the students who were from New York and New Jersey and were very, very affected. This show really reminded me
a lot
of so much about what it's been like in the aftershock of having a terrorist attack where so many people were wiped off the face of the planet.
Sure.
Pretty much instantly.
Sure.
It's interesting to know. I think actually this book was written somewhere around the anniversary, the 10-year anniversary maybe, of September 11th. So I'd be interested to find out how much of that played into him coming up with this
I could see it as a total allegory for 9/11.
Yeah.
And it's almost like when she asks, where were you? It's like that default question, kind of what you were saying. Almost like it's important where you were. You know, but it's not, you know, it's just a conversation piece for people to talk about because their lives have been so changed. And we're talking about 9/11. Yeah, that was a big freaking deal. Like that, you know, 5,000 people or 3,500 people died. But you could point to something. You could point to planes crashing in these buildings. You could point to these guys who were terrorists with a plan. Come in and kill. The difference you have in this show is that there's nothing you can point to.
And 3 years later, they're still debating, and you have the scientists say, I'm fairly certain that God sat this one out.
Oh, that's great, too. And I'm so happy for the writers making that choice. In effect, telling everybody that thought this show was about the rapture, a giant F you.
It was definitely
a
Lindelof.
A big fucking freedom rocket. To everybody that thought this show was about the rapture. And they made it a point to do so.
Yes.
And I loved it.
That was a great, great line.
After all the time you've spent and all the money the U.S. government has spent on you, your answer is, I don't know? Oh, awesome. Awesome. Loved it.
Next thing you know, Kevin has found Dudley's little Keech, what is it? I don't even know what these things are called.
The dog collar?
That's actually what it is.
There you go.
Dog collar, keychain.
Wow, what a hard day. What's that wall in Berlin? Oh, God, that wall in Berlin. What's the name of that?
So anyway, he goes, was his house a mess before or after this? I'm getting all of these freaky things messed up. But he goes to the dog owner's house, and there's that deer standing in the yard.
I know. And was the deer really there, or was he seeing the deer?
Was it a stuffed deer? Was it a toy deer?
Well, I mean, later on in the show, you end up figuring out that it was a real deer.
I don't know. It looked kind of fake to me.
No. Well, at the time, yes, it did look fake. And that's why I think he did a double take on it. Like, whoa, 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 what the hell is that?
And then when he leaves, the deer isn't there. So I have no idea deer are pretty quick, you know?
So he goes to the lady that supposedly owned the dog. And she said, yeah, well, so what? That dog's been missing for 3 years.
No, the weird thing was that I didn't like is how she said, you know, her husband left and the dog's been gone. And didn't she allude to the fact that the dog's been weird? Or she doesn't care about the dog?
Well, no, she doesn't care about the dog because it was her husband's dog. And as soon as the husband disappeared,
he didn't come back.
The dog took off. And
this is why I don't like dogs, all right? Between this and what happens later when the guy's like, these dogs are all weird, I feel like it was said multiple times that some of these dogs just got nasty when their owners went away and they snapped, you know, just like some humans do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all set. I'm all set with these dogs. They freak me out.
And what the thing I liked too about this was, you know, Chief Garvey says, you know, hey, I'm sorry for your loss. I found your dog. He's dead. You know, I just wanted to tell you here's his collar. And she's like, again, he says, I'm sorry for your loss. And she says, is that what it is? Like, and that to me describes all of this stuff. And it describes the whole show. We you don't know how to categorize any of this crap. And people just kind of become numb. They stop feeling because they don't know how to move on with their lives. I remember from the book, there was this one excerpt that said, you knew people disappeared and you knew you had to live your life. And you took the knowledge of people disappearing and you put it in that dark, deep recess of your mind, the same place that you put the knowledge that you're going to die every single day. You put that in the back there so you can live your life. But I think that those walls, 3 years later, they're starting to crumble. And people may be able to move on right now, but now you see people falling apart. And that right there, well, at least leads me to believe that's what's happening.
So another person who was falling apart was this congressman who kind of looked like Santa. I was so happy he ended up jolly in the end. But he gets driven up to go visit this guy, Wayne. This whole storyline, I didn't understand that much. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Everything about Wayne and what Wayne does and what's wrong with the congressman and why this kid's driving him and not answering his dad's phone call. Yeah. I just didn't get any of it.
Well, as we all know now, the kid driving him ended up being Kevin Garvey's son, Tom Garvey. And he brings this congressman and he brings him to this compound. And people got guns, and they're doing these checkpoints, and they're switching cars, and they're going crazy.
And then it's like Cribs with all these hot Asian girls.
I know. Like, what's now? I know what the deal with the hot Asian girls. So let me ask you this: in knowing what the hot Asian girls are, what do you think that they are?
Hot Asian girls who get to hang out in a crib. I mean, if I was told, hey, people disappeared, life is pretty rough, do you want to come live in a mansion, sit by a pool and eat gummy worms?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Except I'm not a hot Asian.
Oh, and how about Tom and Christine, the little Asian girl, flirting? Like, Tom wants to get in on that.
If someone brought me gummy worms that I couldn't get, I would totally be flirting back.
Wait, is that what it takes to get that done?
I love gummy worms, but I'm eating this whole 30 paleo crap.
You know, I'll be right back. We'll get gummy worms.
Okay, so no, what's up with Tom? So Tom has been this kind of shuttle for Wayne's people who need to get fixed. Why does this congressman need to get fixed? What's wrong with him?
Well, you know, Tom says to the congressman that he's burdened. And sometimes he also refers to it as abandoned. But, you know, and then the congressman says, hey, is this guy the real deal? And Tom says, yeah, it's as real as it gets. And obviously, he brings the congressman to Wayne, and something happens. You don't know what yet, but the congressman was unburdened. Whatever he felt was gone, like that. So what did Wayne do? How did he do it? And is this some kind of supernatural power that Wayne has? Or is this something that came as a result of the sudden departure? Did he figure it out? Did he always have it? So
I'm picturing Wayne to be a fantastic masseuse. I'm not kidding. I would go in and let that man work on my back for a while, mm-hmm. get out those knots. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
All right, yeah.
And no,
let's calm down.
No, I'm interested to find out. You're right. What does Wayne do? Is he a voodoo guy?
Well, you know, I'm just going to let this one play out. I'm not going to, obviously, okay. I'm clearly not going to say anything.
And he was very protective of Christine, so yeah. I'm interested to see what her power is.
Yeah, she is very important. And I did read the books, and we're kind of getting into spoiler territory here. So I want to promise to you, my darling wife, and to our listeners, I am going to avoid spoilers as best as I can from
Good.
The book. And as a matter of fact, I kind of don't even want to talk about the book anymore. Specifically because even in the first episode, there have been so many changes. And they're all good changes, by the way. And I'm so happy that they're making it their own entity. So from now on, I want to refer to this show as its own entity. I'm not going to compare it to the book because it's pointless. There's no need in doing it. So with that said, it's apparent to me that Christine, the little Asian girl, is super important. And he's telling Tom that he's got to protect her. And he's also telling him, hey, stay the fuck away from her too as well. And why? Why is she so important? What's the end game? Are all the little Asian girls important?
Nope, she was.
It's just her.
The actress Annie Q, by the way, I was on Twitter the day of the pilot, and I was looking up different people who were talking about the show and using the hashtag and the grace period is over. That was the specific hashtag for it. And I, at first, didn't know that she was one of the actresses because she doesn't say it in her Twitter profile.
Yeah.
So I started to tweet with her. I was like, oh, you're excited about The Leftovers too? Have you read the book? And then I realized who she was, and I had to go back and delete my tweet because I felt like such an idiot. Because
dumbass alert.
Here I am asking, probably what, one of the most important characters since Wayne says she's super important.
I know.
Here I am asking her if she's read the book. Goodness gracious.
Who does that?
I do.
Put a muzzle on that girl.
Oh, gosh. Put a muzzle on the mayor. That's who we need to put a muzzle on.
Oh, my God.
Okay. She's got some good wardrobe and some great hair stylist.
Yeah, she does. But this bitch got to calm down.
She's a little nasty.
Oh, man, she's got some mean, nasty girl stuff going on.
Why? Well, I guess if you're mayor and you're in charge of all these people, I can understand, but Kevin could be just as cranky, and he's not. And he has a tougher job.
So, like, why do you think that they have such a bad relationship? Like, what about this? Is it just because Kevin is just so protective of the people that he doesn't want to deal with the mayor? The mayor wants this Heroes Day parade, whatever, and he's just kind of like, nah, dude, we can't do that. We're just inviting these people to show up and ruin and start what eventually ended up happening, a giant riot.
I think she's part of my cult, the happy remnant. She wears color, she's very positive, and she doesn't believe in negativity.
I couldn't believe how shit on he was by Mayor Lucy. I mean, she really got on him.
Yeah, she was.
And undressed him in that little meeting that they had with everybody around. And you know, one of my favorite lines too was, why are we calling this Heroes Day parade? These people weren't heroes. And one of the guys in the audience was like, yeah, my brother-in-law disappeared and he was a dipshit, you know? Like, so that just, it lends itself to being the not the rapture again. You know what I mean?
It cuts to a high school scene after this.
Oh yeah, with Jill.
Yes.
And Jill gives it to this other girl. She gave her the business.
Ouch. I played field hockey.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you hit each other's legs quite frequently. You try to break each other's legs a lot. You wear mouth guards in this sport for a reason. But man, when she got her smack dab in the nose.
Oof, broke that bitch.
That was nasty.
Wow, man, that was serious stuff. And then I love how when the coach is talking to her after, and she's just like, yeah, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. Just keep that cunt away from me. And I was like, ooh, yowza. Like, you really are. You got some problems, girl. Like, let's calm down here, you know? And
how did you feel, though, about going out later that night? You know, her problems kind of just expanded. How she was talking to her dad and how she interacts with everybody.
Well, that relationship clearly is a fractured relationship.
She's a teenage girl. Everyone has a fractured relationship.
Well,
with
yeah,
parents,
I know. Well, luckily, I'm not a teenage girl, so I never have been. So I don't know about that. But I think it's even more fractured beyond the point of teenage girl versus dad, because clearly this girl was close to her mother, and she clearly loved her mother. And it appears to me that her mother was the rock of this family, and now Kevin, now having problems, mental issues, seeing deer and knowing that his dad, who was the former chief of police, knowing that he went crazy, he is trying his best to just keep it together, and he can't. And you see the way that she speaks to her dad, and he's like, can you just talk to me? And she's like, yeah, this meatloaf is fucking outstanding. And instead of getting pissed off at dinner, he's just kind of like, well, that's the nicest thing everyone's ever said about my cooking, you know? Like, so you can tell that it's more than just a father-daughter relationship, but it's fractured at the same time.
I felt so bad for her at that party. I was a really goody two-shoe in high school, and I never went to a party like that.
Yeah, time out. Because I never went to a party like that either, dude.
That was really intense.
Oh, my God.
I feel like I need to put a chastity belt on my son.
Seriously. All right. First of all, who the hell has an app that spins and says things like fuck, choke,
burn? Ouch.
I know. And what the hell is that about? Who does that? And again, I think that lends itself to the status of what's happening with these people. Think about this. What, she was probably, what, 17, I think? Maybe 16, 17? So the sudden departure happened when she was 13 years old. Can you imagine how fucked up she's got to be in the brain?
That's because of right that? In the teenage years when girls are already trying to find themselves and anyone's trying to find themselves.
And these people disappear on her and now they got to figure it out. And again, this goes back to what I was saying before. I think people are starting to not feel they're numb in this universe of the leftovers. They're numb. And they're doing anything they can to feel something other than the numbness that they're experiencing. For example, like the kid with the fork and getting burned in the arm. Or, you know, let's just go fuck people randomly. Or, hey, why don't you choke me while I jerk off? Like, those things are happening. And they're doing anything they can to experience that. So, you know what kind of reminds me of, too? Remember the movie High Fidelity?
Yes.
And remember when the girls, John Cusack's girlfriend, the father, dies after they broke up, and she meets him up with John Cusack after the funeral, and they get in the car, and she says, I just need you to have sex with me. That way I stop feeling what I'm feeling. I just need something other than this dread. And that's what's happening in The Leftovers. And I think that's why they're playing these games and they're doing all these drugs and having these crazy parties, because they're doing anything they can.
Then she meets those twins. Okay. You want to know what's freakier than that dog?
What's that?
Twins. I know that they're very famous people, though, these actors, but twins just always freak me out. So these twins, they help her find a place to bury this dog. I don't know whose yard they buried this dog in, and they did not dig that deep of a hole.
They were driving a Prius, by the way.
They wanted to play ping pong. They're very precious. I don't even think they were at that party. I think they were across the street.
Yeah, I know. They were like, hey guys, let me in. Come on now.
And instead they help her bury this dog. But they had a lot of insight when they were burying it. I feel like they said something about, we're all going to be dying.
Yeah, you know, they ended up talking about the dogs, about how after all these people disappeared, something in them just clicked or turned off. They went feral. They went totally like animalistic. They stopped being normal dogs. And one of the twins, one of the freaky twins is like, and that's just going to happen to us. It just hasn't happened yet. And again, it's going back to that. These people, the constructs they've created to get past this disappearance, they're falling apart. And you can see that in the very first episode. And talking about the deer, talking about the dogs, they really made it a point to say that things are changing. And when you see the deer, what do you think of when you see deer? You think of like freedom and prancing and frailty and delicacy and beauty. And that, to me, the allegory here is that was life prior to the sudden departure.
I think of Snape's Patronus.
How many Harry Potter references can we make in one episode of The Living Reminders? Let's count them. That's at least three or four.
The deer, the next scene was when the deer pretty much ruined that house. That deer to me is not real. Deers don't know how to open doors. Okay, they're not velociraptors. They're not kids. How could it get its little hoof to open a door? I mean, granted, we saw that it was all kicked in. It was a mess and it opened up cupboards and he didn't really care that much. And when Kevin woke up, he had all these pills next to him and he's also drinking all the time. One of which times I saw him drinking and driving, and I really hope that was root beer because he needs to be setting a good example for this place.
Well, he is the chief of police. You think he'd follow the law, for Christ's sake, right?
Seriously, but he's having a little bit of an issue, and that's why I don't think this deer thing is real at all. Well, because between all the pills that you saw, I think there were like five pill containers.
Yeah, and that, again, that goes back to him being screwed up.
Yeah,
like he's got problems. He's got bigger problems than I think than we care to admit as an audience. And he's going down the path that I think his father is going down. Now, we haven't met his father yet. We don't know what happened to him, but something messed up happened to his dad that drove him nuts, and that's going to happen to Kevin as well. It's going to happen.
Man, just like those deer. So he warns everybody about going to this parade because you're right. He sees himself losing it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I think he knows, you know, he's able to contain it somewhat by his drinking and by taking his pills. But obviously this deer thing is a red flag, in my opinion, that his mind is starting to lose it.
Yeah, and I think he recognizes the fact that these constructs are falling apart too. And then when you at the end of the show, you see the dogs just tearing this deer apart. And in his dream, he hits the deer with his car. You start seeing all these signs of people dogs, feral dogs, insane humans, or humans that aren't right killing this innocent little deer. And it's not like it's Bambi and nothing, but it's this thing that, keeps getting pushed into you as a viewer. So something is happening that's beyond that. And then when they have the meeting, he's saying, people aren't ready to get better. They're ready to fucking explode. Again, people losing their shit. People ready to just burst out their animalistic, feral nature.
So they get to this Heroes Day of Remembrance.
Yep.
Okay, first, that sketch, that's sculpture.
Terrible. That's creepy.
So creepy.
Like the baby's face.
Yeah, it was not.
And I love how they made fun of it in the show too. They're like, yeah, that's kind of ugly.
Yes, terrible.
we can't leave the sheet on the entire time. That'd be a little awkward, wouldn't it?
And the people are there, and sure enough, they are going to protest. And it was interesting to see even the dynamic when Lori, when she wanted to become one of the protesters, when she had to write down, yeah, I wanted to be one of the heroes, or why is my name not up there? I want to go.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if that was for her to become a protester, or was that to stalk Liv Tyler?
Well, I think she also kind of knew that her husband was going to be there. Mm. And I think that she wanted to see him. And I think that she is having a hard time with all of that that's happening. I think she is definitely dedicated to the guilty remnant. Because clearly she left her family. She left her daughter that cares about her so much. But she definitely still has a soft spot in her heart for Kevin.
That moment when the rioting is going on and everyone's beating up everybody, and there was that one shot that showed Kevin helping her get up. And you, at that point, you didn't know,
I know,
that that was his wife or anything.
It was a throwaway scene at the time. But when you find out that big reveal that Lori is his wife, you're like, oh my God, they did see each other. He did help her. It totally blew me away as a viewer.
I almost want to rewatch this episode now, understanding that his wife isn't dead, that mm-hmm. Tom's mom and Jill's mom isn't dead.
Yeah.
And did they understand and did they know, or do they think she's gone? I want to know, when did she leave? When did she decide to just up and become one of these chain smokers?
Well, do you think that they do know? Do you think that they are not aware of the fact that she is part of the guilty remnant? Or do you think that they think she died or whatever?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone talks about her as if she is dead. So I have...
What a good fake out, though.
Gosh, they did an awesome job. I did not see that coming.
Especially when he punched the thing with his elbow, the picture, you're thinking, oh my God, he just wants his wife back. She's gone. She probably departed. And he's so lost without her. And he gets an even worse torture. She's still there. She's just...
choosing.
She's choosing to say, F you. I'm not going to be with you. How terrible must that be? Mm. How terrible must that be for her family, too?
Liv Tyler, whose character is it Molly?
Meg.
Meg.
Yes.
You begin with an M. Meg makes that choice in this episode, and not to fully join, but she just kind of wants to have a sleepover for a few nights.
Yeah, she just wants to check it out, I think.
I really enjoyed watching Meg this episode.
She, how come?
Because she's so haunted.
Mm-hmm.
She is burdened, as Tom would say. You see her and she's trying to plan for this wedding, and she has this dashing fiance who's so excited, and everyone knows that she's beautiful and she's young and vivacious and has this life ahead of her. And yet she just has this cloud over her head the whole entire episode. She can't smile. She's at the event and she sees these people, and sure, she's being haunted physically by the guilty remnants.
Oh, when she freaking wails Lori right in the face when they were like getting on her in front of her house, and she just goes, "What are you doing here? You guys are everywhere!" And she just wails her, mm-hmm. and like you could see her trying to fight for her normal life.
She's trying to fight her depression.
Yeah,
that's really what it was. She is just so overwhelmed by sadness.
Yep.
And she did. She lost it.
And you know, but when planning a wedding isn't a big deal, it's picking fucking centerpieces. That's what it is to her. And imagine how sad that must be too. And why is she so sad? Is it because someone she knew departed? Or is it just because she can't live in it?
I mean, planning a wedding is stressful. So I understand, girlfriend. I mean, it is not a walk in the park.
Oh man, planning, especially with all the family drama and shit. You know, you get all those people.
That in and of itself, skip the whole sudden departure. I mean, that will make you want to join the guilty remnants no matter what. But you're right. Who did she lose? Or is it just that she's so affected by this disaster, by how sad this is, by mm-hmm. whatever it is, loss, whatever you want to call it? Is she just that affected by it? So I'm excited to learn more about her story.
Yeah. So, but let's get back to the riot itself, right? First of all, I loved the juxtaposition of the chief at the parade, walking down and preparing for that. And then you see the guilty remnant, and then they're preparing to go raid this party. And you have Retrograde, our theme song, and the show's song that was part of the trailer, playing as it was happening. And that's another thing I wanted to say, too. I love the choices for the soundtrack throughout the whole show. Some of it was a little on the nose, but I thought it was very well placed, very well used, and it really hit the tension and the emotional aspect of the show home for everybody.
I bet a lot of people wouldn't even notice the music playing. I mm-hmm. think because you and I are so into music, we did. But that's when you want it to be just seamless, that it becomes the atmosphere for them.
Yeah, and then despite the fact that Kevin had told Jill to not go to the parade, she still goes. And he didn't want her there because he knew that GR was going to be there. And I think without knowing that as a viewer at that very moment, he knew that Lori was going to be there. Mm-hmm. And he probably knew that if Jill sees her mom, it's going to be bad news. So I think that's the reason why. Not, yes, because it was the safety thing and all that bullshit, but it was really because he knew he couldn't take the chance of Jill seeing her mother.
And then he goes and he finds her that night.
I know. Oh my God. How brutal was that? I mean, he goes and gets drunk, you know, just pounding beers left and right. I mean, who knows what the guy was drinking, right? And he drives drunk to this place.
Not on root beer.
Definitely not on root beer. Just definitely not on root beer. And he wails this dude to try to get to his wife. And he has that big reveal. I just want to see my wife. Wait, what? Rewind that shit. I just want to see my wife. Yep, that just happened. And as a viewer, you're like, oh my God. And he's sitting there, tell me where she is. You know what? Don't even talk to me. Just point to me where she is.
I wish they had visiting hours. That wasn't very nice. She could at least write to him.
The funny thing is, after pounding that guy, seeing her for the first time, he looks at her and he says, hi, you okay? And it was so innocent. It was so sensitive. It feels like something I would say to you if I hadn't seen you in so long and I knew that you were elsewhere. And I'd be like, are you all right? Is everything okay? Especially after the riot and everything that happened there. And he's told to take off. And he says no. He just asks, he begs Lori to go for a walk. And she wants to so bad. She wants to talk to him. You could see it in her face. You could see the tears welling. And that's why I think, again, her construct that she had is falling apart.
That nasty mother hen, she needs to take a step out.
Oh my God, the stupid freaking sign that says you're not welcome here. And he goes, yeah, thanks for underlining that for me, by the way. I get it. And he just pleads to Lori again, please come home. Please, please come home. And she can't. She can't even take the idea of talking to him. And of course, you know, that's when Meg shows up and she admits to the fact that she just wants to sleep there for a couple of days. But I want to get back to the riot part again. You see Matt, the Reverend Matt, going, this wasn't the rapture. And he's telling all these people, this guy disappeared. He beat his children. And I'm so glad Eccleston's in this show because he's bringing a lot of gravitas to this role, even this very little snippet. And obviously, they're going to develop this character a little bit further. But I'm so happy that they brought him in. I'm so happy they plugged him in at that riot just to let you know that he's going to be there.
We had some listener feedback regarding this episode.
It's listener feedback time. Let's hear what you guys have to say.
And Kelly Parker wants to know, what's up with the chain smoking? Well done. I'm very intrigued. I cannot wait to see what unfolds. And she's guessing that Jill doesn't know that Lori is still here.
Yeah, Kelly, I think you might be right. It could be a possibility because Kevin can't allow Jill to knowingly see that her mother isn't there. Could you imagine as being a daughter, your mother just chose to leave you just because you feel like it? Jeffrey R. says on Facebook, according to an extra video on HBO, the people in the white are guilty remnants who stand as living reminders of the disappearance of the people that are around them. They smoke outside at all times to show they don't care how much time we have left and that we could die at any moment. Jeffrey, you're right. But I also think that it's a little bit more than that. I think it's a tangible sacrifice. It's a tangible thing that they are just polluting their bodies because they don't give a shit anymore.
Mm, that's just so gross. I'd eat cake. On Twitter, Ashley Gray said that she is most excited and most looking forward to being scared in this show. And that isn't an adjective I would have thought about right away.
Mm-hmm.
But ooh, actually, I kind of like
it.
It
is,
yeah,
right. You
being
know,
scared. And Jess Reed, she tweets that the show is intense, shocking, and emotional. Plus, she's a huge fan of the book, so it's nice to see it on the screen.
Yeah, Jess, I think you're right. It was definitely intense. It was very dour. You know, they did have some elements of comedy in there when they're talking about, you know, I get the Pope, but Gary fucking Busey? Really? And they're talking about all the different celebrities that left, like J-Lo and
Shaq.
Yeah, Shaq.
The Pope. Oh,
The Pope goes. So, you know, that was some well-needed levity. You know, that was great. About the book was great. I loved the book, but I can't wait until the show goes entirely on its own. So I think it's going to be a much better storytelling device.
It's going to take the training wheels off. So we had the preview for what's coming up in the future of The Leftovers. I don't think it necessarily said next week. It was just like,
no,
coming
it was just
up
like,
on The Leftovers.
Yeah, coming up. And, you know, you see some really shady shit going on, you know, especially with Tom and the guns and dealing with Holy Wayne and the little Asian girls and what's happening there. And then you start to see how Kevin is starting to fall apart a little bit. And you see a little bit more of a pronounced Reverend Matt, too, as well. And I'm also looking forward to it, seeing what happens with Meg and the guilty remnant. What's going to happen with her? How is she going to deal it? Is she going to join? Or is she there to just get information? Because, you know, she did sit there and she was like, you guys are everywhere. She clearly hated the guilty remnant. Is that her just being in denial? Or is she trying to get information out of them somehow? So what's going to happen with Meg, you know? And then how are all these people going to be intertwined? Is Tom going to come back to his dad? Is Jill going to go with her mom if she finds out? All these things are happening. And how does Holy Wayne play into this? How does the politics play into this? Is all these things going to come back together again? So it's going to be good. We're going to find out. And I wish I had a little bit more analysis for you. But unfortunately, the preview didn't tell us a whole lot. It was just a bunch of random stuff. You guys seen it. You already know. It's time for the sudden theory of the week. All right, Marvin, what do you got? What's your sudden theory of the week?
My name is Mary.
I know, sorry. That's my little nickname for Mary, for those of you who don't know that.
Because I'm always hungry. So he calls me Starvin' Marvin. My theory of the week, Kevin has killed the dog. And that Kevin killed more dogs. And that the deer isn't really there. And there is no guy driving a truck.
That he did it all himself.
Yeah, that's his Dr. Jekyll.
Wow, that's a very good one. Maybe that's him being fractured.
Yes, and so I think that persona of the guy driving in the unmarked truck is actually when Kevin snaps and can't remember things.
Wow, that is an excellent. And I did not know about this theory in advance, by the way. So yeah. And you know what? That would tell you why they couldn't find the truck, number one. Mm-hmm. And then number two, they couldn't find the plates. And remember, he was saying, "What's the plate number? Where's the truck? Just fucking find it for me. Tell me that you don't know."
Because a cop would catch the plates.
A cop would catch.
Well,
it.
He said there were no plates, so I can understand that.
Yeah, but still, like, if this guy is in town, those cops, especially if the chief of police is telling them, "Hey, find this truck," they're gonna find that truck. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah, so I don't think that guy really exists,
and nobody else really sees that guy. Even like at the end when Kevin is talking to the mother who's baby disappeared in the bar and he's like, hey, we're still here. The mother doesn't pay attention to that guy as he's walking by in the bar.
No, nobody sees him. Nope.
Shit, I think you're right about this.
I'm on to something.
You are definitely on about something.
Oh,
about this.
I know. I know I am.
Wow.
So he shot that dog himself in the beginning. And I don't know if there was shooting dogs at the end, if that was just all a dream, but I don't think that guy exists. I think it's Kevin. I need to rewatch it, but it almost looked like those dogs were all the same breed or all the same dog.
Yeah, they look so close to it at least.
To me, I was like, this is just, the dog is this feral, nasty, scary thing that, you know, has gone off from his masters, and this deer was something special and precious that he was trying to save that is now getting eaten by that. Like, I don't even think dogs were killed at the end. I think that was all just a dream, all a weird thing that was going on. But I think he shot the dog in the beginning.
Yeah, and I love how at the end the guy says, Kevin says to him, am I awake? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you are now.
And that's his Dr. Jekyll.
And
Mr.
that's
Hyde.
His Dr. Jekyll talking to him. Oh, shit. Yep. Wow, you are so
that's
smart.
That's my theory.
Dude. Wow. Oh, one other thing I want to mention, too. I loved how they brought the woman back that lost the baby at the end of the episode. It was an awesome, like, it was very poetic. You start the episode off with her, and you finish the episode off with her. And it was great to see Kevin interacting with her and having that importance. Oh, one other thing, too. I'm sorry. I know I have to get to my theory, but these things just keep popping into my head. She asks him, where were you? And he says, yeah, I was cleaning out the gutters.
Liar. You were having
guy
sex.
Guy was lying as fucking high as shit.
What?
Wait, yeah, I know. Sorry. He was lying. He was having sex.
Who was he having sex with?
Who the hell was he having sex with?
Was it his wife?
I don't know.
It looked like a brunette to me.
Was she part of the guilty remnant? Oh, well, no, she couldn't have been.
No, not when it happened.
But why is he lying about it?
Well, I mean, you're not going to tell some girl in a bar I was having sex when it was happening.
Yeah, I know, but why make a point? Like, okay, if he's having sex with his wife, whatever, who cares, right? He's just having sex with his wife. But why make a point as a show to show that he was having sex with somebody? And very purposely, by the way, not showing that person's face.
Because he was cheating.
And what does that say about Kevin? And maybe that's why he feels so guilty about the wife. Because he knows, maybe that's why she went to the guilty remnant.
Oh yeah, I would have.
Maybe she found out.
I'm done with you.
Bitch, I ain't talking to you no more.
You're a cheater.
All right, my theory of the week. The biggest thing I took from this show so far, this is going to be an overarching theory. The biggest thing I took from this show so far was the relationship between Lori and Kevin. They tried so desperately to talk.
They need to learn sign language.
I know. And you can see that her foundation's weak. You can totally see that she really feels bad that she left Kevin. So this is what my theory is this. She's going to cave and the GR is going to find out about it. And maybe Meg is the one who helps her cave, or maybe Meg is the one who trades her in, says, oh no, this lady, she ain't doing right here. But she's going to eventually cave. The GR is going to find out and they're going to punish her. Kevin's going to find out and he's going to try to rescue. But in the rescue, Lori dies. And this sets up the rest of the conflict between the guilty remnant and Mapleton.
I'm like, you just like threw out a crazy long theory. So you think that Kevin and Lori miss each other so much. Kevin's going to try to rescue her.
She's going to give up and she's going to want to go back. And she's going to say, okay, screw this, I should be back with my husband. Because you could see it. You could see it as they were talking. Well, as he was talking to her, begging to go for a walk. And she just wanted to so bad. She was right about to. And then the lady popped in with the, go, you don't belong here sign that's underlined.
Mother hen, yeah.
The mother hen shows up. And somehow, some way, Lori dies. Kevin finds out. And it sets up the conflict between the... Because eventually, somehow, some way, you can't just keep having the GR show up and not talk. I mean, it's fine for the first few episodes, but you got to give them a conflict. Something has to happen to force them and the town of Mapleton to be at odds with each other.
Ugh.
More than what they are already. And I think that's what's going to happen. There's going to be a serious hunt down here. That's my theory, and that's my guarantee.
I love it.
Please hang up and try again.
Blake and I gave you guys our theories of the week. We really want to hear about your theories, what you think is going to be happening. So we would love to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at Living Reminders. And that's the same name for Facebook. So you can either search us in Facebook, The Living Reminders, or if you just go to facebook.com/Living Reminders, you can find us. And our website is thelivingreminders.com.
And one of the cool things we have going here too is you can get us on the Living Reminders hotline.
So what's a hotline?
Oh, it's the hotline, baby. No, you can call in to a Google voicemail account for us. It's going to ring, but it's going to go straight to voicemail. We're not going to answer to be like, hey, what's up? You know, it's going to go straight to voicemail, and you can leave your theories. You can leave some love for Mary and I. You can leave your ideas, your reactions. You can even leave some hate for Mary and I if you really, really like. That's okay, too. And just call, and the more you guys are able to get in touch with us, and the more you're able to do these voice messages or whatever, or Facebook or Twitter, the better our show is going
to
be.
And the easy way to call us, if you just go to our website, thelivingreminders.com, there's a button right there for you to push. So you can call, honestly, right from your computer. It'll just use the microphone there.
Yep.
The number is also there if your computer does not
just,
have a microphone.
And just for our purposes right now, the number is 503-454-6730.
Last but certainly not least, if you're listening to this on iTunes, we would love it if you could rate and review us. As you know, The Leftovers Show is really going to start taking off, and we want more fans of the show to learn about this podcast. So it would be great if you could go to iTunes, leave us a review, let us know what you like or don't like about the show. But remember, if you like this so far and you want more friends to be on The Leftovers discussion, review it. Give it 5 stars. Let us know what you like about it, and more fans will become part of this conversation. We just can't wait. We are already so excited about this show, so excited to enjoy it with you.
I'm sure we missed a ton. I'm sure there was things that we either messed up or we didn't talk about. So if you want to get in touch with us about those things, please do so, because we are clearly not perfect.
Thank you all so much for listening to The Living Reminders. I'm Mary.
And I'm Blake.
And we'll talk to you guys next week.